Yeah, we're giving you the old Clockwork Orange treatment for British references.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, that's okay. Look, I've had my, not the first time I've had my eyes pinned open. It won't be the last.
Feeding you mild cheddar and sitting you down in front of Ant and Dec.
Oh,
we've
my
got
God.
Patrick Wayman on the show with us.
Pat me eyes.
You see, the baker people, right? They came along in the late Bronze Age.
Like, I can't tell you how good it is to laugh with you guys. Like,
hello and welcome to Masters of Adamane, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about, at least temporarily, Spartacus Blood and Sand. I'm Milo Edwards and I'm joined for the first time in 2 weeks by both my co-hosts, Phoebe Roy and Patrick Wyman. How are we doing?
Doing good. Doing okay.
Another day in paradise, baby.
Another day in paradise.
Another day in paradise. I still need a good thing to say to in response to my intro.
Mm. Yeah, you need to develop some dad-coded... You know, clinging on for dear life style.
Well, what should I go with? Because I can't do Living the Dream or Another Day in Paradise. Those are both parts.
I've culturally appropriated those from overwhelmed fathers all across this country, all across these great United
the
States.
The backbone of this nation.
I'm not an overwhelmed father.
That's we got to find you something else. But this is I've become much more aware recently of the fact that like middle-aged white dudes do have their own ridiculous language.
Mm.
Talk about like you're on thin ice, buddy.
Yeah.
That's one more time. Say it one more time.
Hmm.
Like that's the we've got a whole array of them. You're just socialized into.
Hold your horses, buddy.
Hold your horses.
Yeah. These are the words of your people.
Yeah. Would you take a chill pill?
Yeah.
The
middle-aged British dad vocabulary is less extensive, but I feel like it is stuff like it's doing a little clap and then saying right, or going just subtly going should we make a move.
Then you want like to that. Beat the traffic.
Oh yeah.
That's dads everywhere. That can't be
another classic.
Ready to
God damn it. I've said that so many times. Oh God. Oh, this is getting me, man. Oh man.
This is hitting for real.
Oh goodness. Yeah. Okay, so I went to a concert on Sunday night. I went to see the Goo Goo Dolls and Dashboard Confessional.
Oh my goodness me.
Incredible
Dashboard
stuff happening.
Professional, man.
Incredible stuff happening here.
Stuff happening with presumably people who've got like, who by this point have presumably got a kind of serious deterioration of the cartilage around their joints. At this point.
That was very much the vibe. Yeah. Yeah, it was, the people watching was incredible. Cause again, this is Arizona. And it was 107 degrees outside as this concert was happening. So, but the drummer for Dashboard Confessional, I say this with love. He was putting it out there. He was doing work. He was headbanging everything. But he had a really noticeable bald spot. And
beautiful.
I noticed this in like the first song they played and I couldn't get it out of my head. It felt like such a fucking metaphor for the entire concert and everybody there that I could not get it out of my head. I saw the bald spot and the lights are shining off the bald spot. You can't not see it. And I'm like, God damn it, man. How old am I? Yeah. Like,
well, it's indicating the fact that Dashboard Confessional are spiritually monks.
Yes. Yeah. It was basically a tonsure.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't even like a bad bald spot, but it was just there. And maybe that says more about where my head was at that night than anything else.
Well, the next night at the same venue, Dashboard Evensong were also on, and also Dashboard Mass.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess a monk.
Come
could
on,
take
that deserves something.
Yeah.
It was even maybe like
the tonsure and professional.
Yeah.
And
no.
Yeah.
Got
no,
it.
You were right. You're right. When you're right, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Dashboard Gregorian chants.
Yeah.
I'm gonna keep saying monk stuff until one of you laughs.
Dashboard anchorite.
Yep. Fine. Yep. Like it.
Yep. Why not? Dashboard vegetable patch.
The dashboard Carthusians.
Dashboard Carthusians is now, that's like a real band name, but in a slightly different genre.
Yeah, dashboard Carthusians are like black metal, I'd say. Yeah. They're the kind of metal band that you're like, kind of, if you listen to them, you're like, okay, no, this is fine. And then like with the other hand, you're like looking up Wikipedia just to make sure that they're not Nazis.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Either that or they're like real landfill indie, like, we're the dashboard Carthusians and this is Phone Box. Like it's it's very like Radio 1 introducing, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
Have we run this one into the ground?
Yeah,
I think we've finally. At long last. Look.
You need to think of an intro phrase for me. So, because when we were doing Seinfeld, I would say hello and then you would say that's all she ever says. We stopped doing that. We're not doing that anymore. If I said hello, you don't respond. I'm like Uncle Leo chasing Jerry down the street saying, "Milo, hello."
Uncle Phoebo,
exactly. Yeah. So I need something to say that's not appropriating from dad culture.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say peachy keen jelly bean? Is that okay?
Oh, that's good.
Can I say that?
I think that works. Yeah.
Can I bring that back?
I think that's at least a high quality starter. It may not be what you settle on.
Okay.
But but I think that's a real good
point to start negotiations.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's an opening bid, shall we call it?
Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
So give us the line, Phoebe.
Peach keen jelly bean.
Yeah, beautiful.
God, it's got a nice ring.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
Like when you say it has a sort of upbeat ring to it, but if a bloke said that, I'd be like, this guy, I need to get this guy the number for the Samaritans.
Yeah, I think we.
Peachy keen jelly bean.
Peachy keen jelly bean. Yeah, no, I think
Johnny Cash voice.
It's time.
Peachy keen jelly bean.
I blew my son's mind by playing him some Johnny Cash songs from the 50s and then playing him Hurt. And I was like, this is the same guy. He's like, that can't be the same guy. He's like, I'm like, 50 years, man. 50 years will do that to you.
50 years of prescription drug addiction will.
And a prescription drug addiction. Hanging out on the road with Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. Like, yeah, that'll do
Crikey.
It.
50 years of being a little too peachy keen.
Mm.
Jelly bean.
Mm.
Johnny Cash, RIP, what a guy.
All right, thank you, Jeremy Vine.
What a bloke. We're gonna play some beautiful Johnny Cash stuff later on. Kick against the pricks, what does that mean?
What do you mean by that?
Sounds great,
though. What do you mean
though?
By that, Johnny?
The virgins are trimming their wicks, Terry and in Wellin.
That was a deep cut Johnny Cash line too. My God.
Yeah, I'm honestly surprised that you know that much.
When the man comes around, indeed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what Vernon Kay is very concerned about on Radio 2, when the man comes around, and by that he means when Jeremy Vine's handover period begins. I'll tell you what, Jeremy, I've been listening to Johnny Cash. He's got so many songs. There's a lot to learn.
I will never tire of your various UK regional accents. I will never get tired of that, ever.
That's a dangerous assertion to make, Dr. Wyman, because I can run these into the fucking ground.
Yeah. Motherfucker, I said what I said.
Yeah.
Did I stutter?
You did not.
I'm quite sure of myself.
Ooh, you did not hesitate.
Did I stutter? No. That's aggressive dad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's also quite like Valley Girl aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Did I fucking stutter?
No, I don't. I don't think I'll say. Did I?
Trust me, as someone who has interacted firsthand with many of those people, it is actually quite accurate. Mm. There's a lot of overlap between passive aggressive dad and Valley Girl.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States,
you got to think horses, buddy.
What's that?
Amanda, would you take a chill pill, please?
You're on thin ice.
I heard a girl outside a pro wrestling show in Reseda say that.
Mm.
So literally the valley, a valley girl,
a long day
say that
in Reseda. Yeah.
Freeway running through the yard, man.
Yeah. Right. Well,
And that is also an accurate description of Reseda. Tom Petty didn't lie.
Tom Petty has never lied, I think.
Well, one Tom Petty's never lied. The other one.
Yeah. Break your heart.
Tells the truth.
Look, we're not here to talk about the relative veracity of Tom Petty's various claims, although that is something that probably will be explored in future episodes. We are here to talk about Sparks, Blood and Sand, episode 10.
Cool. You know, I realized literally this week that the episodes have titles.
Oh yeah,
they do, don't they?
I did not take that in before.
I'm not sure it matters.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest with you. Like, there's a lot of stuff about this show where I'm not sure it really matters.
So this like episode is called Party Favors.
Yeah. Yep. We love a party favor.
Very clever. That's a very 2010 Stars episode title.
It is, yeah. All right. So, let's talk about what happened.
Yeah, do you want me to do the summary?
Yeah, give us a little synopsis here. I mean, actually, before you do the synopsis, I have silly things and serious things. Would you rather do you want to talk about serious things first or silly things
serious
first?
Serious things first for dinner and then silly things for pudding.
Silly things for pudding. Okay, wonderful. Delightful. All right, so love Milo, synopsize us. All right. What do we got here?
Spartacus and Crixus are set up to fight in an exhibition match for Numerius' coming-of-age party, and Crixus sees a chance to resume his position. Battiatus, realizing Spartacus' importance to his ambitions, invites him to play a board game called Latrunculi. But Lucretia jealously disapproves of the two men sharing wine. Meanwhile, Naevia has troubles with the guard she stole the key from and risks all to share time with Crixus. At the party, a now revived Lilithia, still haunted by memories of the murder, seduces Numerius and has him switch Spartacus' opponent to Varro. Despite it being an exhibition match, Numerius further surprises by not granting mercy to Varro, forcing Spartacus to reluctantly kill his only friend. Later that night, after Battiatus' interest in politics is dismissed by Calavius, he vows blood revenge for his fighter's death. Distraught with grief, Spartacus returns to his cell and vents his rage until Mira comes in to comfort him.
That's probably the cleanest synopsis we've read of one of these episodes.
Mm.
Okay, so serious stuff first.
Okay.
This episode does a really good job of showing us the omnipresence of hierarchy in Roman society, mm-hmm. that hierarchy is just constantly present. And no matter how elevated you might seem in one context, there is always someone above you. Right. So we see this with the interactions between the different enslaved people, mm-hmm. that some of them have higher status than others. We see this in the interactions between Battiatus and Spartacus, between Spartacus and the guards. We see this between then at the end of the episode, and this is the capper on it, between Battiatus and Calavius, where Calavius shoots down Battiatus's ambitions. He's enraged by this. He thinks he's good enough for it. The irony of that, and I think what we're meant to take from it as viewers, is that Battiatus is completely blind to the ways in which he takes completely for granted the hierarchical position that he's in. Mm-hmm. Like, he feels his lack of status relative to those above him so keenly, and it completely takes for granted as the way the world is supposed to be, the power that he exercises over his household. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big driving theme of the episode, is who has the power to command, who has the power to help, who has the power to hurt. Mm-hmm. And how does that impact all of these people's relationships and their understanding of themselves and where they are in this hierarchy? It's that, I think, is the serious bit of this, mm-hmm. and what I like about this show is it shows us how arbitrary that authority is. Like the death of Varro, right? Like, we're talking about killing a person for revenge, because young Numerius wanted to get his dick wet, because he wanted to look like a big deal in front of his friends. His father applauds the decision to not grant mercy to Varro, because that's him being a proper Roman. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, that's meant to look cruel and callous and frankly kind of silly, right? Like, it's silly that it would be silly if it weren't people's lives at stake, the way the Romans are standing around watching this and enjoying it and clapping for the blood. And like, it would be silly if these weren't people's lives. But what I like about this is that that's the reality of the Roman world. However we want to gloss it, however we want to look at, you know, fine white statues or artistic depictions or like, you know, soaring texts talking about the glory of Rome. That's really what it is. It's roomfuls of spoiled rich people, celebrating the labor and blood that they wring from literal other human beings.
Yeah.
And this, the killing of Varro, we can talk about all of the ways in which it's telegraphed throughout the course of this series, the shortcomings of the acting involved, but the decision to make this the crux, because this really is a crux. This is a turning point in this show. This is the incident that's going to take us to where we know we're going to go. At the end of this season, I think it's a pretty well-earned moment in terms of building the themes that make it make sense in context.
Yeah.
That's my serious analysis.
Okay. He had to go because he looked like he was from the Bowdoin catalog.
And he did,
that just wasn't going to fly.
He did, Varro?
Yeah.
Does he look like he's from the Bowdoin catalog?
Oh, it's a very Bowdoin catalog look. The haircut.
I'm just trying to think if I'm misunderstanding what you mean by the Bowdoin catalog.
Well, there's obviously mini Bowdoin.
Yeah.
But then you've got your regular full.
Then you've got your full size Bowdoin.
Yeah, it's less well known Bowdoin because it's kind of like it's like the full size Bell and the baby Bell. You know.
Yeah. No. I know. You don't have to like explain to me what
you don't have to Bowdoin explain to me.
Baby and adult. It's just like I always associate the Bowdoin catalog with being like very kind of like middle class catalog, like kind of everyone in it looks like Pierce Brosnan.
Okay.
Not like curly blonde, because I think he's got more of a sort of surf look. I would say Varro.
Cap, you a surfer guy.
Yeah,
well, I'm now looking at Bowdoin and I see that actually the adult clothing they only do is women's, and actually it's all boys otherwise male.
I thought they did do menswear. Maybe they don't anymore.
Yeah, they've ceased.
They've ceased and desisted. After one too many.
Yeah, a lot of class action.
Difficulties. Yeah, well, because of the exploding quarter zip. Please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it was a tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Well, the a lot of the Abu Bowdoin al Baghdadi is that?
I mean, I guess so. I'll allow it on this occasion. I know you're very tired.
Yeah. Could that be? I like the idea of Bowdoin ISIS. That's a fun.
You do not, under any circumstances, have to hand it to Bowdoin ISIS. But,
however,
out in the Levant in their mid-price casuals.
Yeah, it's the Lebanon Bridge.
Yeah,
you need to be worried.
Regular
about.
ISIS referring to Bowdoin ISIS as mid-priced casuals.
Oh,
they're not
God.
Even vaguely concerned with destroying, you know, ancient monuments.
Do you think they have like a territorial ISIS? Who are just like,
well, do it at weekends and then like one training camp a year.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
I guess that is kind of being like an ISIS sleeper cell in like a Western country, right?
It's like
you got
their,
regular
it's like
ISIS.
It's like their hobby. They do it. Yeah, they do it at the weekends.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's levels to jihad. We know that.
Yeah.
Bloody kids drive me mad. If I didn't have territorial ISIS at the weekend, I think I'd lose.
Yeah. Do you reckon regular ISIS have a mean nickname for them, like van drivers?
Yeah.
Bread knife wielders. Look at him, dirty casual. He's never fought the YPG in his life.
I'm sure. I was going to, like, there's obviously a hierarchy there.
Yeah. Right?
Like there has to be. I do remember, like, I knew people who worked in like security studies in the Caucasus, and all of them were like, the ISIS stuff actually great for us, because all of those dudes just went to Iraq or Syria and got killed. Like every ISIS sniper was some guy named Umar the Chechen, who had spent the late 90s and early 2000s just sniping Russian soldiers in Grozny. And then all of those guys went to Syria and Iraq and got killed. And so now the Caucasus is substantially less violent than it used to be.
There you go. Yeah, they either joined ISIS or got into UFC. Either way, safely shipped out.
There are two wolves inside you.
Like an exchange program.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, it's a very wolfy place, the Caucasus, so it would make sense.
It's a very wolfy place.
Yeah.
Half of Chechen fighters are nicknamed wolf. It's Borts in Chechen.
Oh, right. There you go. Yeah. Come on, mate. It's called Jihad, not Jeezy.
I used to know somebody who had a dog named Grozny.
Ooh.
It means terrible. The city is literally named terrible, right?
Iran Grozny, yeah. Yeah, it means, yeah, like kind of terrible in the sense of being scary.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the capital of Chechnya. I think that tells you everything you need to know about Chechnya as it exists in the 21st
century. The dog was named after the capital of Chechnya.
What was his stance on Ramzan Kadyrov?
Unclear, because she was about 8. But I think she'd heard the name on the news, or heard her parents talking or something.
Sorry, I thought you meant the dog was about 8, implying that the dog might have, in some later years, developed more of a perspective and been able to
on the geopolitics of the Caucasus.
Well, by 8, you'd hope that a dog would have some kind of coherent.
Yeah, I mean, they're middle aged for a dog.
Coherent line, exactly. No. The dog's owner was about 8.
I see.
Makes sense. But it
still was weird. Now I look back on it.
Yeah, that's. I have questions.
That was curious.
What is the child's stance on the anti-gay death camps in Chechnya? I'd like to know that. You can't culturally appropriate Grozny and not have a take on the repressive regime of the Kadyrovs.
I'd really, really like to see you on like Take Your Dad to School Day.
Do you know how hard I have to work to not just like shout things out or just offer to like go to their classes and do history stuff? Because if I do that, it'll make them hate it.
Yeah.
And I can't. So I'm like, I'm here if you want to talk about it. Nothing would make me happier. I will recommend books. But I'm not going to push it on them, because if I do, then they'll hate it. And that would be just tragic.
Yeah.
The boy's teacher last year listened to my show and used it to prepare for when she was doing ancient history stuff, and she had left it on and on her Bluetooth speaker, and it popped up and started playing my voice in class. And of these kids, or 12 kids in this class, 7 of whom I have coached in various sports, and not a single one of them recognized my voice. So I don't know what that says.
Maybe you've got like a mic voice.
I think I do.
Or a coaching voice.
Or a coaching voice. That's more likely.
God damn it.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
You're on thin ice, buddy.
Just get out of here. Run. Run. That's coaching voice.
Listen, sweetie. I'm tired. That's the Valley Girl dad.
Yeah. And Hendrix, I am begging you to not kick that ball in my face again. I am begging you. Yeah.
I'm literally begging you.
Please don't kick the ball in my face.
I made that joke on your Instagram about how you should do, we should do a series called Bedtime Stories of History. And I'm now completely serious about this. I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite things, I think people are embarrassed to tell me this, but they're like, I love listening to your show while I fall asleep. And I think people expect me to be like, oh, I'm that boring. I'm like, no, sleep is the best thing in the world. If I help you fall asleep, like nothing makes me happier than that.
Yeah.
People sometimes tell me they listen to Trash Future to fall asleep. And I'm just curious as to how that's possible. I'm not offended, but I'm just like, if that can put you to sleep, the voices inside your head must be so loud. Like if that's like peaceful to you. Yeah.
That should immediately put you on a track to getting tested for something. I don't know what, something. But something.
Sure, for sure, something. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. What did you think of this episode? Like, am I giving it too much credit for its emphasis on hierarchy? Because there's also a lot of really silly shit in here.
Yeah.
There's some extraordinarily silly things that happen in this episode.
Like, honestly, I am infinitely more interested in Batiatus and Batiatus's attempts to become a kind of proper Roman. I think that's much more interesting than anything else that's going on. I know I've mentioned this before. I'm not especially interested in Varro. It was so telegraphed that something terrible was going to happen to him. Particularly after he reunites with his wife, and you're like, oh, okay, so he and his wife have made up, and they have this very touching scene when he tells her that the child that's not his is still going to be you know, loved like the child is his, and you're like, okay, well, there we go, tick tick boom, time is up, Varro, that is it for you, sunshine.
You will be dead by the time the credits roll.
We knew you were gonna die, and it's gonna be now probably. So I couldn't get too exercised about it. I quite like the stuff about Lucretia and working out that because Alethea lost the head somewhat, and which, by the way, like I assume you spoke, you guys spoke about this last week, is so like we're talking about, like, oh, do you think that this is like an earned thing of the narrative? Like, it, that was so not earned. There's absolutely no reason whatsoever to think that it is likely that this woman is so brittle and concerned and anxious about her position, that if somebody who is deemed to be superior to her laughs at her, that she would go mad and like and cave their face in on a marble floor. There's like, that is not part of the characterization of Alethea so far. It's part of the characterization of Lucretia. Like, Lucretia is the one who's extremely concerned about her position, and who constantly has Alethea like giving her these kind of like bitchy little snubs, which makes me wonder if when they were writing it, they briefly forgot which of these women have this character trait. So now Lucretia has Alethea on this leash because she knows that she has killed Crassus's relative. Did they ever say who?
They said cousin.
Cousin. Okay. So she's from a powerful and rich family, and so Alethea has to do what Lucretia and Batiatus tell her to now. Mm. And as is my understanding, what they tell her to do is they tell her to go and seduce the young
No,
man.
No. She does that on her own.
What?
That's Alethea seeking her own revenge and playing her own game against Lucretia and Batiatus, because she wants revenge on Spartacus.
Oh, okay. Well, then I misunderstood.
She wants revenge on Spartacus, and so she uses Numerius to exact her revenge. Alethea has sex with Numerius in order to get him to make Varro fight Spartacus, and then for Numerius to give him the thumbs down so Spartacus has to kill him.
It's true.
That's all Alethea's plan.
It's true. It didn't quite make sense if Lucretia is behind this somehow, even though Lucretia does hate Spartacus.
She does.
She's always going on about how much she hates Spartacus. So again, that is like a brand new piece of characterization for Alethea. And it seemed very, I don't know.
I mean, can I offer a counterpoint?
Yes, please.
One of the really defining things about Roman society is this intense and constant competition and striving. That Roman society, one of the ways in which Roman society makes sense to us as people in the 21st century is that ambition was the driving force.
Yeah.
And that there were channels through which you could exercise that ambition and try to rise. Mm-hmm. So if you're an enslaved person, you can seek your freedom. If you're a freed person, you can use the patronage of your former owner and try to rise as a tradesperson or a doctor or whatever. If you're a Lanista, you can try to become the best Lanista. If you're a senator, you can try to get elected to higher office. And so if we understand all of Roman society as these interlocking networks of people who are all trying to get ahead, however they define that, that's actually a pretty good way of understanding what made Rome Rome and why it worked for as long as it did, because it does offer you opportunity within restricted boundaries.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're a Lanista, you can rise to be the best Lanista, but you can't become a senator. Mm-hmm. If you're an enslaved person, you can be freed, but you're never going to become like a highly respected member of society. They're always going to remember that you were once enslaved and you will carry that status forever. Mm-hmm. If you're the child of a freed person, maybe you can rise into that next level, but nobody's ever going to let you forget that one of your parents was a slave. Mm-hmm. And so you can rise, but at the same time, there are also these constant pressures pushing you down and forcing you into your lane, mm-hmm. essentially. That's something that's really fundamental to Roman society. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like about this episode is that they play with that in a whole bunch of different ways, like this whole episode. And the reason why I thought the Licinia and Alethea thing worked, even though you're absolutely right, like the idea of her just murdering that woman out of nowhere was, it literally came out of nowhere. But if we view all of this as this really intense, overwhelming status anxiety,
yeah,
that pervades every aspect of Roman life, that policing the boundaries of what's acceptable and who can do what to whom is a really important piece of how Roman society functions. And so I like that it kind of leans into that. Now, with that said, immense number of like absurd, ridiculous, funny, over the top things that happen here.
Well, as someone born and bred in the United Kingdom, I have to say it's really hard for me to get my head around this societal structure. Yeah. Ambition is permitted as long as you very much stay in your lane. Hard to get my grasp on.
But so I would say, even if that's how American society functions in practice, it's not how American society functions in its idealized version.
Sure.
So I think for Americans, that's a much more shocking contrast. The idea that you can't just be whatever you want to be. Mm-hmm. Even if obviously the reality of American life is that there's less social mobility than there used to be, even at the peak of American social mobility, it still wasn't anywhere close to the rags to riches story or pulling yourself up by your bootstraps that people have wanted to believe. The ideal was still there. And that ideal for American viewers of this show I think it would hit a little bit different. That would be the idea that you're so constrained and restricted by the circumstances of your birth or by other people telling you from above what's allowed. That's a lot harder pill for Americans to swallow.
That's interesting. I mean,
I think that's my take.
I think it's a perfectly reasonable take. I understand what you mean about this like ever-present status anxiety, but it still doesn't account for Alethea suddenly having not just the kind of the red mist at being laughed at by somebody who considers herself to be her social superior, but like honestly, like the sheer brute strength that it would require. Like she turns into like the Hulk when she caves other women's face in, and it just seems a little bit unlikely. My other complaint about this episode, but bearing in mind that I apparently didn't understand one of the major plot points, so who's the dummy here? Is it me, or is it the writers of this show? I couldn't remember at what age the Toga Virilis ceremony takes place.
15, 16, somewhere.
See, that's
14,
what
15,
that's
16.
What I thought. But the actor playing Numerius does not look that old. He looks to me like he's like 11 or 12. And
oh no, you haven't spent that much time around 11 and 12 year olds.
No,
in the recent past, yeah, 11 and 12 year olds look a lot younger than that.
Oh, do they? Okay, I think it's maybe just because he is very much from the kind of the drama school conveyor belt of young British actors, all of whom might look and in fact be a certain age, but because they are all taught to speak in a certain way, they all sound like kind of precocious 5-year-old princes. And so Numerius sort of turns up, it's like, "Father, I would so like to see a gladiator fight. Oh, isn't this exciting, Father? Oh, look, the gladiators are fighting. Look, that one has a wooden sword. Oh, do replace it, Father. Give him a proper sword. Let them kill each other, Father." So it's a little bit hard to then square that with the scene when you then are watching him have sex with Alethea, because it's gross. It's really gross. It's really like, why is that there? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Also, just one quick question. Is she wearing a merkin in that scene?
Oh, that's really interesting. I thought something similar. And so so I rewound and had a good look. I had a good look at her area. I had a good look. Yeah, exactly.
VAG decision. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, very good. I gave it the VAG decision. And it's not a merkin. It's a little kind of gold belly chain with a sort of kind of chainmail sort of statement necklace situation in the middle, like something you might wear to a club in 2009.
Huh.
Which is appropriate to the period, of course, okay. from 2010.
This is the thing, like, it's not a reasonable Roman period piece, but it is a 2009 period piece.
If you look at the goof section of this episode, there's actually a Jane Norman bag in shot in the background of one of the scenes.
Thank you for your service in going back and rewinding to see that, because I felt like it would have been real weird and creepy if I'd been like, I went back and rewound. Yeah, I was just trying to get a good view there.
Yeah.
Your wife walk in on you like rewinding and playing?
Yeah, no, yeah. She has walked in on me a couple of times watching this show, and I'm like, it's not what it looks like, I promise.
I'm rewinding for historical commentary. This is historical pussy inspection. This is not perverse pussy inspection.
This is my job. I would appreciate a little respect for the work I do to put food on this table. And sometimes that involves inspecting a historical vase. That's
kind of where we're at.
The vase Romanum.
the aura of Argus.
Who doesn't love a Roman sheath?
Who doesn't love a Roman sheath? The aura of Argus, that's good.
Thank you.
That's really the thought. Okay, so yes, all of this is because a lot of this is just immensely silly. When they squeeze the dude's head off with the chain in the arena, I fucking laughed. I died laughing. I'm like, I don't. Like, come on, man. Like, what are we doing here?
It's unfortunate. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, didn't care for that. But the one thing I want to say about our friend Numerius here, imagine how many...
Gosh, Father, isn't this all terribly splendid?
Imagine how many of those guys actually did exist. Like, spoiled, cosseted, Roman youths who are going to grow up to wield immense power over other human beings, right? And they are exactly this spoiled, cruel, callous, inhumane, all in service of their own enjoyment, pleasure, self-aggrandizement. That we can look at that dinner party and we can focus on the absurdity of it. But and we should, because there's a lot to talk about now they chose to put these scenes together. But I think the baseline thing of like, these are deeply cruel people who whose position in the world is dependent on their exploitation, like literally squeezing other people like to the last drop. I mean, and the way that they talk about Vara, well, like, oh, yeah, I'll compensate you for the value of the man. That's like, that to me is what hits about this episode. And that's what I take away from it. Like, the fight scenes in this one are pretty silly. A lot of the dialogue is really silly. I think it does some fun stuff with hierarchy and with position. And like, we shouldn't think of Roman society as having been full of these like grand orators who are, you know, out there like going for the glory of the res publica and all that. Like, no, it's deeply selfish people doing cruel things because it makes them feel good.
Yeah. Which I think is interesting. I think that's like that's an interesting aspect of the show. And that's why I like the stuff with Batiatis and his political ambitions. And that's why I'm less interested in what's going on with Spartacus and co. I feel like at this point, I feel like Crixus having drunk the Kool-Aid, I think is getting more and more absurd. When he keeps saying stuff like, you know, oh well, you know, I would earn it fighting in the arena. It's like, have recent events not communicated to you how incredibly what an incredibly disposable object you are deemed to be, even by people who claim to revere you?
But this is the. It's really hard to break an established system of power and domination.
Yes, fine.
I just read the wonderful historian of the Enlightenment, Robert Darton, just wrote a book on Paris before the Revolution. So he covers from about 1745 to 1789, right up to the storming of the Bastille. And what he does is try to figure out what is the mood of Parisians during this time. Like, what is it? The book's called The Revolutionary Temper. And it's all about what were these people thinking as they're watching these events unfold and participating in these like pretty momentous events leading up to the French Revolution. What does that look like? And what Darton, I think, is really good on, and I think the big takeaway from it for me was how long it took, how many indignities, how many openly oppressive acts, how many times the government appeared to be completely incompetent, contradictory, like not doing its job in the way that it was supposed to, that it took fucking decades of this.
Yeah.
Before,
oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean that,
before the people of Paris were willing to rise
which
up.
Which makes perfect sense. But this is a TV show and Crixus is a fictional character. So
this is all true.
It's not necessary to, because like, if honestly, like if this show was just going to try and kind of accurately portray how long it takes for a revolutionary mood to build up, that's quite a lot of episodes to just sit there watching Crixus getting more and more annoyed.
But I'm okay with a little bit of the slower burn, that like, because when he snaps,
yeah, you know, he's gonna, know, you know, he's gonna snap, you know, he's gonna snap and good. No, I do get that. And also, I mean, like, you know, in scrupulous fairness for someone living in the UK, where no matter what people say about, you know, oh, well, the thing about the British, no one pushes us around, you know, we will, and it's like, well, that's simply not true, is it?
The only person who's going to push us around is us, all right?
Yeah. Americans tell themselves the same story, and yet the people in this country love the taste of boot.
And yeah, like, and I think we have to remember whenever we're talking about like historical revolutions, is like what incredible incentives there were against any kind of rebellion. because you really like there really were some very, very horrible punishments for people who tried and failed to rebel.
We saw a guy get his dick cut
off.
Yeah,
and we don't have horrible punishments for people who try and fail to rebel. I should probably, honestly, on this one, I should probably wind my neck in with saying, like, oh, come on, Crixus, let's look a little bit lively. Let's be having you on the revolutionary front. Okay, fine, fair enough.
Delia Smithius.
Exactly. Let's be having you.
Where are you?
Where are you, Crixus? Where are you?
I can't hear you.
Exactly.
I don't disagree with you at all. It is a TV show. They could do it. And also the materials that they're working with here, man, let's be honest. How much emotional depth are we expecting from the people that they've cast here?
Well, that is true.
Cripes, father, I've had sex with a MILF.
It was frightfully wizard. Now I'm going to watch an innocent man die in front of me and then still be home in time for the tuck shop to be open.
Again, accurate depiction of your average 16-year-old Roman aristocrat.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But I think the problem is because of having done HBO's Rome and this being portrayed with such perfection by Eaton Augustus, that I think any kind of pale imitation of it just feels like a pale imitation. I'll tell you something that grinds me gears about this program.
All right.
This is something that I coined this. I call the Don Draper effect, which is where you have a main character in a historical drama, and it is necessary, even if occasionally they engage in anti-hero behavior, you still fundamentally have to quite like them, or certainly like them enough to very much be on their side and be rooting for them, right? And so in order to do that, said character is frequently written as behaving in very anachronistic ways. Mm-hmm. So for Don Draper, I think the most annoying one of this is that he is very, very much not a racist. And they frequently are at pains, or throughout Mad Men, to point out the fact that Don Draper is not a racist. And I appreciate how difficult it is to write sympathetic characters from times past. But again, TV writers, like successful ones, like that's quite a nice job. It's fine. That is an all right job. You're not down the mines, are you? You're not cleaning squid. It is a perfectly all right job and you can work out a way of doing it.
Cleaning squid my game. Mind.
It is a well-paid, pleasant job, and you need to find a way around it, which is not just, well, Don Draper would just unlike every other, probably the case that other white men of his age, background, and professional status would probably be really quite racist in the early 1960s in America. It doesn't make any sense that you have this one character who for some reason isn't, because they don't character.
They also don't ever really explain how he ends up being not racist, do they? It's been a long time since I've watched Mad Men, but do they? There's no background. No. Yeah, I mean, because,
particularly since they're at pains to point out that everyone around him is really, really, really super racist. So it makes it look even weirder as a decision.
Yeah. So I think that's even more objectionable for this show with Spartacus than it is for Don Draper.
Yeah,
because
it's the Don Draper effect. And what they've decided to do, in this show is they've decided to make Spartacus not just like a decent guy, but an anachronistically really, really lovely guy who never does anything wrong and is always just being very, very good and very, very decent. And it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Hates a shag, loves his dead wife.
Yeah, they've basically made him a late 18th century English abolitionist.
Yeah.
And that's like, That's so much worse than Don Draper being not a racist in the context of anachronism, because there were not a lot, but there were people in the United States who demographically fit Don Draper who were not just not racist, but avowedly anti-racist in the 50s and 60s. They were those people did exist. They weren't a lot of them. Whether we think Don Draper would have been one of them.
That's what I'm saying. Like the countercultural anti-racist in America of the 1960s were not working in advertising in New York.
It was not Don Draper. No. And the difference with Spartacus, and I think this is actually only going to get more jarring as we get toward as we reach the climax of this season and what we all know is going to happen here. There were no abolitionists in the Roman world, in anywhere in the ancient world. We do not have, so far as I am aware, a single text making the argument that slavery is a moral wrong.
Oh, this is actually interesting. There is, it's not a contemporary text, and I can't remember where I read it, but it's very much a post-Christianizing text, which argues that Spartacus is a kind of early adjacent Christ figure, and he, the real Spartacus, I mean, and he genuinely believed that slavery as an institution was immoral. His followers didn't, and we can tell that his followers didn't, because the first thing they did when they went rampaging through the countryside was any slave owner who they took captive, they would immediately enslave. So the issue was not the idea of there being slavery, the issue was the idea that they were slaves, which, you know, probably fair play. If you happen to live in a slave owning society, what you don't want to be is a slave. I can sort of see that. But yeah, this, I can't remember where it is. It's like, it's not Eusebius, but it's like, you know, one of those guys. One of those guys.
That's entirely plausible. And it tells you a lot that it comes from a Christian or at least Christian milieu source. Yeah. That it's that further. It's like, that's what it takes to formulate a critique of ancient slavery in terms of humanity.
Yeah.
And not in terms, like, every other critique of slavery is all about how do we do it better? How do we get more from these people? It's never, is it right to own another human being? That just doesn't exist. And amount.
I'm sorry. How on earth else am I going to get anything done? I mean, it's listen to fucking little wacko over there. How on earth am I meant to have conniving conversations with my wife if I can't clear the head a little bit in one of my speaking tools?
This is so, but the other piece of it, because again, like, yeah, nobody is questioning this, but also slavery was not always as ubiquitous in the Roman world. Like the kind of slavery that we see here was not a given. It developed under a specific set of historical circumstances, mostly mass enslavement as a result of Roman conquests. Mm-hmm. So in the third and second centuries BC, all of these wars the Romans are fighting end up pumping tens or even hundreds of thousands of enslaved people into the Roman economy. And so the form of slavery that we end up getting, where these are speaking tools, where they are chattel, and the that specific structure is a product of those circumstances, but it proved to be extraordinarily durable even after the kind of initial conditions that put it in place were no longer present. When there were no longer Romans going out and conquering and, you know, selling 50,000 people into slavery at a time, the institutions around slavery and the slave trade all remained pretty set. Like, to the extent that we can see a development, it's that it gets less brutal over time. I really think there's something to be said, like, for the specific historical moment when the Spartacus rebellion happens, that really, to me, that is the peak of Roman slavery as a cruel, brutal, exploitative institution. Mm-hmm. And whether it becomes less so because of these enormous slave rebellions and owners are kind of like, maybe be a little nicer, or whether that was happening anyway, or what the deal was, the Roman world isn't static. It's not a monolith. And these things happen at specific times for specific reasons, not just because there's this eternal state of struggle between the enslaved and the owners. But yeah, I mean, I think like when you put war captives into slavery and brutally mistreat them, a lot of the time, those are the circumstances that give you slave rebellions. This happens in the Americas too.
Yeah.
When some plantation owner buys a new string of guys fresh off the Middle Passage, it's like, oh no, you just bought a war band from Angola. Like, and so there are multiple cases where this happens in the New World, where recently arrived basically warriors are enslaved and they don't take well to it, and you end up with a slave rebellion on your hands. So gladiators, it's interesting because a lot of them are war captives. The people who rebel on the Latifundia, the big kind of slave worked plantation type estates that covered the Roman countryside at this point in time, again, largely staffed by war captives. So it's not like this comes out of the slave rebellions aren't so much coming out of domestic slavery as these extraordinarily brutal and exploitative forms of Roman slavery.
Mm. Mm.
Makes sense.
Right. Makes well, sense.
That's like my biggest beef with this show, that Spartacus is like you said, not just an abolitionist, but also just the slave girl gets sent to him.
He's fucking Harriet Beecher Stowe or something.
He's like, you wouldn't be consenting properly. It wouldn't be right. And it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, he's doing a reverse Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah, yeah,
and mm-hmm. yeah, and I that mm-hmm. I 100% agree with. I'm of two minds as to whether this show could exist structurally without that. Mm. That we need him as a mirror to show us just how shitty the system is.
But I mean, again,
but
this
I
is
don't
like,
think
this is,
so.
This is,
I this think is, you're probably right.
This is something else which I think is and we which we discussed at length when we were talking about. When we're talking about HBO's reign, it is that, like, either you're making a period drama or you're making a historical drama. And yeah. Something that is done, I think, very, very well in HBO's reign is they try and be as historicist as possible.
Mm.
And one of the ways in which they do that is they don't have the characters being anachronistically decent or behaving in ways which are deemed to be more kind of palatable and moral to a contemporary audience.
Is this, I mean, God help me, is this us saying that this show is crying out for Pullo and Varinus?
I think it's crying out for Pullo and Varinus. I think we need a Pullo. Because this is the thing, because Pullo and Varinus in HBO's Rome are really, really good mirrors to kind of hold up to not just the action but also the aristocratic characters to show actually what it is you're looking at. But they never go too far with, well, you know what, Varinus,
you know what,
a little bit of a feminist actually, like it doesn't it's so
Lucius Varinus,
so
definitely not a feminist,
jarring. No. but it's so jarring when Spartacus gives Varro like a thick ear for being horrible to his wife.
You got to call out your mates, you know.
Like,
call out your amiki.
You know,
he's calling out his amiki. You can't call out your amiki.
That is a totally fair and valid critique.
Thank you.
I think that is entirely valid. This is not a subtle show. Yeah. We've come back to that time and again, but it's worth repeating. Like, this show is a goddamn sledgehammer. It's just going to hit you with stuff. And sometimes you're going to say yes more, please. And sometimes you're going to be like, come the fuck on.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you're somewhere between those two poles is Spartacus Blood and Sand.
Yeah. Yeah, somewhere between male feminist gladiator and conniving MILF lies the truth of of Spartacus Blood and Sand.
Yeah, I mean,
conniving MILF and the feminine and the anachronistically feminist gladiator guard the door. Who do you trust?
Congratulations to Alithia for crossing over into conniving MILF territory.
Yeah, that's episode. True. Oh, yeah. This is a lot of conniving, and yeah. Lucretia is doing a lot of conniving as well.
This is us giving her bar MILF, sir. She's officially a full-grown MILF now.
Oh, Jesus, God.
Finally broken, Pat. Dying moments of the episode.
Oh, you got me. Oh, Jesus. Fuck. Oh, that was good. Oh, but a bar milfsa?
Yeah.
Or bot milfsa.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. You would be more correct there.
Well, I hope that one enters our canon of terms.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be the counterfoil to the... to the toga virilis.
Mm.
Yes, is yeah. When the MILF with not a merkin seduces the young man, that is a bot MILFSA.
It's one of the
just drape her in a cougar pelt.
yeah. Finally, captured in Cappadocia.
Yeah, one of the symbolic.
Oh Jesus!
Symbolic
on that note,
parts of the ritual. Yeah.
Has her first glass of Whispering Angel, and then off she goes into the world.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. Makes an appointment to have her pool cleaned.
Thank you all for listening to this episode. This has been a Patreon one, so thank you for supporting the show. Thank you for giving us your money. You're funding our very own Batmilf, sir.
Yep.
Yeah.
We love you all dearly.
I'm going to be celebrating mine later on this year.
That's right, yeah. You now meet all the criteria, congratulations.
Because you can't do it immediately. You can't do it like in the first year because you've got to like do your kind of postpartum recovery.
Yeah.
As soon as your child is one.
I would 100% attend a bat milfsa.
Yeah, you
that
fucking would.
That sounds like a goddamn. I heard it after I said it.
Well, I'm a little boy.
Will you call me a good boy, please? That's
the. The listener couldn't see Phoebe's face at that moment, but we could, and it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yep. On that note.
Yeah. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week on the free feed. Come see one of my work in progress shows. There's tons of them up on my website. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.